This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 30th, 2017.
We're not going to comment on Jared. We're just not going to comment.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Jared Kushner just wants to help. So why can't the media just leave him alone? That's a very charitable view of Kushner's overtures to Russia early on in the Trump transition. President Trump's son-in-law and senior White House advisor, Jared Kushner, may have been a bit overeager in his interest in Russia last year. As The Washington Post reported on Friday, Kushner discussed opening a back channel for communication to the Kremlin with Russia's ambassador to Washington, Sergei Kislyak, last December. Seasoned ambassadors know to deal with one administration at a time. So why did Kushner think he could, as a private citizen, bypass the intelligence community, the Obama White House, his own father-in-law, and maybe even Michael Flynn, who was on his way to getting in all sorts of hot water over speaking with foreign governments? Mark Lowenthal is former assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production for the CIA under the George W. Bush administration and current president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. The Kushner gambit, Lowenthal says, has no precedent and is absurd on its face.
There are two problems. So number one, they had no official role or function. There's only one administration in the United States at a time. It does sort of breach how most incoming administrations behave vis-a-vis the outgoing administration. They don't try to sort of overrun them. And the second thing happens to be the parameters by which Kushner was apparently, and I have to stress apparently, offering this, that he was going to come to the Russians, come to the embassy, and use them as the means of the back channel, not just that he was talking to them, but it's handled by the Russians. And that's extremely, extremely problematic.
But during the Carter administration, Carter-Reagan transition, didn't the Reagan people have all kinds of back channels to the Iranians that resulted in the release of the hostages?
No. Warren Christopher, who was the deputy secretary of state at the time and was negotiating with the Iranians in Algiers, told them, look, as of noon, January 20th, Washington time, my commission ends. So if you don't get a deal with me, I walk away. You get to start again with a new team.
And so that's what happened. The Reagan people didn't try to preempt that.
No, absolutely not. The Iranians decided, you know, this is the best deal we're going to get. We don't want to deal with this new guy. And they made a deal in Algiers, but they wouldn't free the hostages until after Reagan had taken the oath, just to snub Carter.
Let's take a situation. What if during the first George W. Bush term, that Condoleezza Rice, who's a world-renowned expert on Russia and criminology and the Soviet history and knows all the people in Russia, if she had offered to have a back channel with the Russians, would anyone have raised their eyebrows at all?
Yes. It would have been the same problem. It's not just the fact that Kushner is in a neophyte. It's the fact that that administration's not in power. And you just don't do that to the sitting president. And the Bush people, I think, they had a firm sense of history in place. A lot of them had been in his father's administration, and they would have known better than to do that. It's presumptuous. It's dangerous.
So in the case of Jared Kushner, then, it's either extraordinarily and dangerously naive or explosively provocative if you know what the situation is. And Jared Kushner likes to present himself as a very intelligent young fellow.
He may know a lot about real estate in New York. I wouldn't take that away from him. I don't think he knows a lot about presidential transitions. He does now, but he didn't then. And he doesn't know a lot about foreign policy. He just doesn't. That's not his field. There's no reason to expect that. And there's also this the naivete that you mentioned, John, to think that you could have this conversation with the Russians and that the American intelligence apparatus would not be aware of this is incredible. And even if Jared Kushner didn't know better, you would have thought, although probably not, that Mike Flynn would have known better because he was an intelligence officer. So to think that you could talk to the Russians and somehow create a channel that nobody else will know about is fallacious.
It also seems to suggest what was coming out of some of the statements of President-elect Trump and the people around him, that there was contempt for the national security apparatus and the intelligence institutions collectively, that they could do better.
Yes. I mean, well, look, Trump called us Nazis during the campaign. And his contempt for the intelligence community was palpable. It supposedly has gotten better. I mean, the briefings appear to be going well. But there's this extreme distrust of the of what Bannon calls the administrative state, of the apparatus of government, and an extreme unfamiliarity with it.
Let's talk about the Logan Act for a moment. What qualifications does the Logan Act attempt to regulate or license to allow someone to actually do what Kushner was imagining that he might have been doing for the national interest?
The Logan Act was passed during the John Adams administration when we were in a quasi-war with France, and it states that private citizens may not negotiate with a foreign power with whom the United States is in a dispute. And so in the 200-plus years of the Logan Act, one person has been successfully prosecuted under it. Kushner probably did not violate the act because of the phrase in dispute. I mean, clearly we have a contentious relationship with the Russians, but it's more generic than specific. And so I'm not sure you could charge him under the Logan Act successfully.
So my mission here is just to try to create any conceivable example here that Jared Kushner might possibly fit into such a category. And you're saying, no, absolutely
well,
not.
Here's one that may or may not be applicable. When Nixon was running for the presidency in 1968, he had intermediaries, including Anna Chenault, the widow of General Chenault, tell the South Vietnamese government, hold on, you can get a better deal when we come into power. Now, we weren't in a dispute with the South Vietnamese. They were our allies, but Johnson had gotten everybody to the table at Paris. And I would say that that may be, and I would stress maybe here, John, that may be the closest analog you can find. So Tu and Nguyen Cao Ky were told, hold out, you can get a better deal.
Should there be sanctions or a punishment for Jared Kushner? For instance, his security clearance be revoked or rescinded in some way?
I don't have a firm enough basis for saying yes or no. I mean, he didn't have a clearance when he did this. He didn't have access to classified when he did this. I'm not trying to make excuses for him. I'm just trying to lay out the parameters of where we are. Nobody knows the details. And this is a case where the details really matter, John.
Mark Lowenthal, former assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production for the CIA. Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome, John. Bye-bye.
Mark Lowenthal is currently president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Immigration policy, the federal stalemate, talk of border walls, talk of federal agents overruling local authorities. And in Texas, talk of state officials acting as federal agents produced an honest-to-God scuffle yesterday in the Texas legislature. A protest of more than 1,000 immigrants' rights supporters descended on the Capitol in opposition to the state's new anti-sanctuary cities law. The protest stirred up tensions to the point that one Republican legislator called ICE on the protesters. Outraged Democrats confronted conservative Republicans until one lawmaker threatened gunfire. Will Weisert is Austin bureau chief for the Associated Press.
There is a real tension in Texas between people that think that the state should have a more relaxed view of immigration and shouldn't have police enforcing federal immigration law. And then people that think that these people are that people are in the country illegally are lawbreakers and need to have the rule of law enforced on them. And that's what you sort of saw play out. There really is a lot of passion on both sides on this issue. And when it was really raucous and we didn't really know what direction things were going to go, it was easy for that to kind of spill out. And that's why you saw some of the scuffling and some of the threats back and forth.
Part of the frustration is that the state is trying to enforce this, and the mechanism for the state to enforce federal law is unclear. It's much more clear at the city level and the county level than it is at the state level, and that's part of the problem, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that this law will not actually take effect until September, so we don't know exactly what it will look like. It's been enforced in other states, but to sort of mixed results and legal challenges. So we're not sure what the effect will be. But opponents of the law say that it's going to spread fear more than anything else, that people that maybe even they're not in the country illegally, but they have friends and relatives that are, and they're going to be afraid to interact with the police. The other interesting part of the Texas law is we are the first in the country that actually would put police in jail, potentially put them on trial and potentially face jail time for refusing to enforce federal law. And there's also a mechanism to remove them from office. So that really, it's not just a question of police saying, well, I don't want to enforce this. They could actually face criminal penalty for not doing so. And that just ratchets up the tension on the side of law enforcement as well.
But wouldn't you say that this level of frustration that you're talking about mixes rather unfavorably with the inclination over the last couple of years to make conceal and carry weapons more available and more present in places like state legislatures and college campuses, et cetera?
It is certainly true that, you know, we have a real reputation in Texas of being a culture that really loves guns. Now, you know, the state capitol has been a place where for many, many years, there are metal detectors at the door. But if you have a concealed carry handgun license, you don't have to go through security. They assume that you're armed and you're allowed to come in without going through the metal detectors. In fact, a lot of journalists have that same pass, not because they have guns, but because they don't want to wait in line at security at the Capitol. So having armed lawmakers is not a new thing. Having them threaten to shoot one another on the floor of the legislature is a territory we haven't been in before. And I think you're right that, you know, when you have tired people and a lot of emotion, and you have to assume everybody's armed, things can get a little bit more tense pretty quickly.
It certainly does underscore the tensions involved in the immigration debate. That's for sure, Will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Will Weisert is Austin Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, speaking to us from Austin. The disagreement between some U.S. cities and federal immigration authorities means cops have had to tread lightly or be caught in the middle of a big national debate. The White House has called for a change in the law to pressure local police to enforce federal immigration policies, including detainer requests for undocumented immigrants. The city of Seattle has sued the Trump administration over its threats to punish cities by removing federal funding for uncooperative jurisdictions. So in the Seattle suburb of Auburn, where one out of every 10 officers is paid under a federal grant program, it's a little dicey. Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW Public Radio in Seattle takes us on a police ride-along in a suburb where cops may be choosing between what they call reasonable immigration enforcement and their own paychecks.
Four out of 50, he can send me to that as well.
Police officer Aaron Williams furrows his brow as he reroutes toward a 911 call.
This call is just a little bit weird, so...
We cruise through Auburn, a suburb just south of Seattle, where the Latino population has more than doubled in the past decade. Williams has worked here 17 years, and he recently took a new role on the community response team. A big part of his job is to create closer ties with the people who live and work here.
And specifically down here at 25th and F, in this area, is a large Hispanic community. So we're trying to kind of understand, okay, so what's the best way to connect with them? You know, is it through Facebook? Is it more, you know, community meetings, bike patrol guys being down here and us being out on foot?
Auburn's community response team has grown to 3 officers in the past couple years, thanks to a federal COPS grant. COPS is short for Community Oriented Policing Services. Auburn's been awarded $2 million from this fund in the past 5 years. But it's one of the police grants that Trump officials have threatened to cut from sanctuary cities. Sanctuary's a fuzzy term. It generally refers to policies that restrict information sharing or the use of local resources for immigration enforcement.
Somebody called 911?
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did. Okay, let me pull over here. You guys okay?
Yeah.
We arrive at the 911 call. An 11-year-old boy had reported his twin sister was missing, and a dozen kids cluster on the sidewalk. It turns out the sister is fine. 2 more cops roll up on bicycles, and the kids, all immigrants from the Marshall Islands, surround them like paparazzi and fire off questions.
You have a gun?
I do.
Yes, I do. I have a gun.
And you guys going to kill people?
No, absolutely not.
Some of these kids have seen the bike cops around and challenged them to a race. A few parents look on from the apartment steps. As we head back to the station, Officer Williams says he'd love to see the bike patrol expand because they get to know a lot of people. The COPS grant pays for these bike officers, too. In fact, it pays for about 10% of Auburn's police staff.
Well, that's a big deal for us.
This is Auburn Police Commander Steve Stalker. He's managed these COPS grants and doesn't think his department's policies on immigration should put this money at any risk.
We never have and never will. We don't actively go out and look for illegal immigrants. However, if the federal government does contact us and come into Auburn with an active case and they ask for our assistance, we will assist them. That's law enforcement assisting law enforcement.
Stalker says officers don't ask about immigration status. Auburn's policy also says it's unnecessary to notify ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement when someone is booked into jail or hold people in jail extra time while ICE investigates, unless there's a warrant or criminal charge. One of President Trump's executive orders aims to withhold money from places that hinder ICE, and it's raised questions about what criteria the feds will use to define these so-called sanctuary locations. It's unclear if Auburn's policies fall into this category. But what is clear is that U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants more cooperation across the board, as he indicated at a March press conference.
But fundamentally, we intend to use all the lawful authority we have to make sure that our state and local officials, who are so important to law enforcement, are in sync with the federal government.
Sessions also noted that $4 billion in law enforcement grants is at stake, including that COPS program that Officer Williams is a part of. Several cities, including Seattle, have filed lawsuits challenging this executive order and to seek clarity on the legal limits of cooperation between local police and ICE. In Seattle, the loss of these police grants would be a small drop in a big budget, and city officials have taken a high-profile stand in the fight over sanctuary cities. But in suburban Auburn, the city council is moving cautiously about whether to adopt this label.
I don't support the word sanctuary city because of the funding issues.
This is Auburn's deputy mayor, Largo Wales, at a council meeting in May.
But I do think that we need to take it up a couple of notches, and we need to go to an ordinance.
The city council is debating an ordinance that would strengthen sanctuary policies, including more explicit wording that city staff don't ask about immigration status. But there's hesitation to hoist this flag higher and potentially draw scrutiny from the feds. Auburn resident Vidal Rojas, choking back tears, encouraged the council to act.
Que estamos gastando nuestro tiempo, que están ahí sentados ustedes muy cómodos y nosotros podríamos...
Why are we wasting our time here? And you guys are sitting here really comfortable, and we're all here putting all our energy into this.
Rojas said he wants children growing up here to know they're supported. This tug of war over federal funding for things like bike cops in suburban neighborhoods is set to continue in court, in Congress, and in cities across the country, whether they label themselves a sanctuary or not. For The Takeaway, I'm Liz Jones.
Quick update on this story. The Auburn City Council has since passed a resolution that prohibits city employees from asking about a person's immigration status. Many community members had pushed for a stronger ordinance that would make that policy legally enforceable. The city of Portland, Oregon remains in a state of grief following the death of two men, Rick Best and Taliesin Mirdin Namkai Meshe. A third, Micah David Cole Fletcher, was hospitalized but is expected to survive. All three were trying to protect two women, one apparently Muslim, from a knife-wielding Jeremy Christian. Charged in Friday's attack and with a history of making racist extremist statements online and in public. 21-year-old Micah David Cole Fletcher is a student at Portland State University. His mother, Margie Fletcher, told the media that the fact that her son would protect strangers is no surprise.
I've told him his whole life, one of these days, Micah, I've always worried about it, but he's always been that way.
Rick Best was a 53-year-old father of four who served for 23 years in the military.
People in that, we all bleed red. It doesn't matter who, what color, religion, it doesn't matter. Like, we're all human beings.
Taliesin Mirdin Namkai Meshe was also killed. 23 years old, he graduated in 2016 from Reed College. His family said, "We ask that in honor of his memory, we use this tragedy as an opportunity for reflection and change. We choose love." While he was a student at Reed College, Namkai Meshe took Introduction to Islam with Professor Kambiz Ghanay Basiri. His impressions of his late student tell a story of how a teacher can have an extraordinary impact outside the classroom.
I need to listen in context of a course he took with me in spring of 2015 on Islam in the modern world. It was an introductory seminar of about 15 students. And I remember him particularly because of how the impact he had on me, because of how earnest he was about wanting to educate himself about Islam so that he could counter the prejudices and sort of discrimination that he felt Muslims in America were facing. I sensed a little bit of a disappointment in him in the class when he learned that the class wasn't going to directly address these issues of prejudice and stereotype. Usually when students come to the class with his motivations and backgrounds, they either do one of three things. They either drop the course, they check out intellectually and mentally from the class, or they sort of give up on their attempts to be able to address Islam in terms of the headlines and just take that academic route. And Tayshan stood out in my mind in particular and challenged me in that class because he didn't do any of those things. He never gave up trying to understand Islam in a way so that he could explain it to others.
It is the dream, I suspect, on some level of all teachers that their students become empowered enough to make a difference in civil society in classes such as yours, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the things that for me, because I also, a lot of my research is and scholarship is on Muslims in America, is how we as Americans are going to remember what happened in Portland a few days ago, that whether we remember it in terms of Taliesin standing up to prejudice or whether we remember it as him laying his life, laying it all on the line for the vision of the world he envisioned, that he was willing to stand up for and ultimately give his life for. And it was beautiful to see after the event on Saturday, there were two vigils that were held in Portland. It was beautiful to see the world he envisioned actually be materialized in the diversity of people from a variety of ethnic, racial, and religious backgrounds that came to these vigils. One was held in Portland at the site of the Hollywood Transit Center, and another was held at the Muslim Education Trust and sponsored by the Muslim community, and both were attended by politicians and local religious leaders and leaders of the community. So I hope that we remember how he came to see the world and how, out of the forces of conviction, he stood up and sacrificed himself for it.
You've had a bit of an emotional journey over the last 72 hours.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's for those of us who've been teaching Islam in the past couple of decades at universities and colleges throughout the United States, I think we're all very conscious of how what we teach in our classrooms may affect everyday lives in the larger world. And this brings all of that home for me and makes me much more aware that it's possible. And to have such a wonderful human being give his life in this way, it's really proud in many ways and heartbroken.
Professor Ghanayab Bassiri, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. One of the great historic things that happened in the 2016 elections that got lost in the post-election turbulence over the unexpected Trump victory was that Maine approved a ballot measure to implement ranked choice voting. Voters can rank candidates, first choice, second choice, third choice, instead of just picking one. The method is mathematically more complex, but it eliminates spoilers and expensive runoffs and produces a more accurate picture of who voters think is the absolute best candidate. But Maine's Supreme Court is advising that ranked choice voting violates the state constitution, which stipulates that a winner is whoever receives the most votes, period. The state legislature can now repeal the measure or amend the Constitution, and the whole thing has put Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap on pins and needles. Or maybe it's that he's in the bullpen or the dugout.
Well, election law is a little bit like baseball. There's a rule for everything, but there's a reason for the rule. And in Maine, it's written into our Constitution that state elections are decided by plurality votes. And that's because we had a multi-candidate race in 1879, back when the elections were actually run by the political parties, not by the Secretary of State. And in the constitutional construct of the day, if nobody got 50% plus one in a multi-candidate race, then the legislature would figure it out. The problem was that there was a lot of questions about legislative elections which allowed for people then to reasonably take up arms and march on the Capitol. And there was a near insurrection. And when it was all settled, the legislature said enough is enough of that. And the Constitution was amended to say that whoever gets the most votes wins the election, whether it's 65% or 35%. That's the problem that ranked choice voting ran into with the Supreme Court, because ranked choice voting allows then multiple rounds of voting. So they said it would unconstitutionally eliminate the person that got the most votes in the first round.
So the state constitution doesn't distinguish between most first place votes and most second or third place votes.
That's correct. It's just who gets the most votes. So the remedy now is for the legislature to contemplate a constitutional amendment. And failing that, there's talk about simply repealing the whole thing and starting over.
How difficult is a constitutional amendment?
In this political climate, it could be a pretty heavy lift. It's not a partisan issue. However, the landscape, Republicans tend to distrust this far more than Democrats do. But Democrats are also split as well. You need a two-thirds majority in each chamber of the legislature to offer a constitutional amendment to the voters, which would then be ratified by a simple majority. It doesn't seem likely, from what I've been hearing in the hallways, that the legislature has a lot of stomach for a constitutional amendment at this time.
If it were implemented in Maine and were successful over a couple of voting cycles, do you think it would catch on nationally?
I think it absolutely would. I mean, this has been one of the challenges of selling it, is that no state is doing it. A few municipalities do it, like our largest city in Maine, Portland, uses ranked choice voting to elect the mayor. And people there do seem to appreciate it, and it doesn't seem to cause difficulties. But they're also all tabulating machines. They don't have to do any hand counting. You know, we have 503 towns in Maine. Almost half of those hand count their ballots. So ranking choices could be very problematic to get results in any quick fashion. And then how do you conduct recounts? And then there's the expense of it. So there's a balance of advantages and disadvantages. Certainly implementation is something we'd have to really work on fairly quickly. And it's still on the books. The Supreme Court decision didn't strike it. It's just an advisory opinion. And that's why the legislature has to act pretty quickly. But if it were implemented and it were successful, I think you'd see it probably take hold across the country.
Matthew Dunlap is Democratic Secretary of State of the great state of Maine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
While our friend, Maine Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap, waits for the wheels of government to turn now that the courts have spoken, Democratic State Senator Kathy Breen from Maine's 25th District is choosing the heavy lift of amending the state constitution in order to allow for the ranked voting system to be used.
Well, we've cleared the first hurdle in that we were able to get the constitutional amendment through the after-deadline bill process. So we've got permission from our leadership to run the bill. And I think that's a good sign that we've already cleared the first procedural hurdle, and now we'll draft it and get it to the Committee of Jurisdiction.
The city of Portland already does this. Does that mean the Portland delegation on both sides of the aisle would probably vote for this?
Well, it's possible, but I think what's really important is that the state of Maine really has a long history of election reform, including the clean election program, and the ranked choice voting system is another way that Maine is leading the country in election reform and trying to develop programs that can reduce partisanship. And that's a big priority in my district. And I think that the voters of Maine have expressed their desire for less partisanship in our voting system. And ranked choice voting is one way to get to that goal.
Do you think there was a way of writing the ballot measure that would have accounted for the court's problem with the sort of most votes question that really dates back to an issue in 1879? Could you have anticipated this and avoided having to go to the state constitution?
I think probably we would have had to go to the state constitution either way. I think really it was more a matter of the sequencing. of whether we went to the Constitution first and then went to the voters, or went to the voters and then the Constitution. Either way, I think that, you know, the voters have spoken and they're interested in ranked choice voting by a 52-48% margin. And especially in my district, it was very popular. So now we'll address the issue of the Constitution.
So you're really going to the heavy lift with the voters having spoken as kind of an ace in your back pocket.
That's right. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we were able to get in an after deadline bill, because Maine has a citizen initiated referendum and a balloting process. And those laws that are passed by citizen initiative have the full force of the law that is the same force as a legislative law that's passed. So, you know, it is law right now. And I think that that's one of the reasons that the legislative leadership was interested in having the bill come before the full legislature. And like any other law that we pass, the legislature can also amend or repeal laws. But we are always very, very hesitant to do that when we have a ballot initiative. And in general, the legislature feels that we should honor the will of the voters.
Do you feel this is in the tradition of, and my list here is going to be incomplete, but, you know, you've got statesmen who were out of the mainstream, but very much ahead of the country in so many ways. George Mitchell, Olympia Snow, Thomas Eagleton. I mean, there's so many Maine politicians, Angus King, who represent positions that really would move the country forward. Is this in that tradition?
Absolutely. And I would add Bill Cohen to that list. You know, we certainly have a long tradition of Democrats and Republicans who are really, really moderate and pragmatic and really interested in problem solving and not hyper-partisanship. So I think the ranked choice voting system is really consistent with that tradition in Maine politics.
First sign that this would, you know, what's your first step along the journey?
Well, the first step happened last week when we got the bill in to be heard this session, and I'll be working with the revisor's office today to get the language finalized. It's not that complicated. And then get it to the committee that works on election issues.
And then after committee, it's two-thirds all the way, right?
That's correct. It needs a two-thirds vote from the legislature, and then it has to go back out to the voters on a referendum.
All right, Senator Breen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
According to the latest economic figures from the government, Americans are showing signs of some financial smarts in the midst of a very slow-growth economy, where consumer debt is near an all-time peak. Consumer savings in March went from 5.6% to 5.9%. At the same time, consumer borrowing reached $12.7 trillion in the first 3 months of 2017. Rising savings is definitely a good sign, but rising debt can also be a good sign. People are buying more. But if it reflects ballooning student loans and just high-interest credit card debt, that could put brakes on the economy. The choice between savings and debt in individual households tells the story of consumers' persistent struggles. Stories that some of you are anxious to share.
This is Emily Lattimore in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. We learned to live with the reality of credit card debt, which we were both able to avoid for most of our adult lives. But now, with two kids, two cars, a home that always seems to need some sort of maintenance, it's a matter of managing debt as opposed to escaping it anymore.
This is Harold Vickers calling from Port Orchard, Washington. Yeah, we've taken on some debt, but it's planned debt. So we're doing some major home renovations, and our plan is to work together to pay that debt off, and we're looking at a two-year payoff. So I don't think debt is always detrimental, just how you use it.
Hi, my name is Mac from Portland, Oregon. We are in debt. We have a lot of expenses we don't need, like internet and TV, and that's compounded by the huge cost of our necessaries going up, like healthcare, property taxes, and food that's not from a box. With two kids, as a couple, we need to make about $4,000 a month just to make ends meet and have even a small cushion.
Matt from Portland, Oregon, sounds like he's confessing a little bit. Well, debt is a serious problem, and Ebony Brown comes from Elgin, Illinois, outside of Chicago. She grew up poor in Gary, Indiana, and she takes us much deeper into how she's had to learn to keep her head above water.
When I was growing up, you know, our family was very particular with just going to work and just making ends meet. So there was no conversation around the dinner table about savings or about purchasing a home or budgeting, any of those things that really are necessary to secure a strong financial future. So what I'm doing now is just what I just mentioned, all of that. You know, I have a budget. You know, we stick to it. You know, you have to have your emergency fund savings. You have to do planning for your children's future. You have to plan for retirement. So there's a couple of things and strategies that I've implemented to help me with that along the way. But first, very early on when I was first out of college, you know, I fell into that same pool with my parents of really not knowing how to manage money. And I think that I just got tired of not being able to enjoy life and to not see myself grow. And I think I had to just change that.
Well, you're tired of the stress is what you're saying, right?
Right. The stress of it all. Right. The stress of not knowing if you'll ever come out of being able to have savings set aside. The stress of not knowing if you're going to live paycheck to paycheck, or, you know, the budgeting of, do I have enough money just to do everyday things such as get groceries and get gas and pay bills? And you have to make changes in order to accommodate and overcome that.
Most people are raised with the idea that you don't talk about money. Is money being a secret a problem in a family where maybe everybody doesn't know the numbers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that money needs to be an open communication. I think that children need to be taught from a very early age how to budget, how to manage. Myself, I have 3 children. One is an infant, but the other 2 are 5 and 7. And they have a chore board and they earn an allowance. And when I give them their allowance, I make them pay me $1 back for taxes, because that's something that they have to get used to, something that has to become a part of their everyday knowledge and vocabulary as they get older. We talk about savings, and then we talk about spending. And we talk about whether it's important to spend your money on things or spend your money on experiences or save it for something better at a later date.
Ebony, is your husband on your team with all this, or does sometimes he fall off the wagon?
You know, I think that I've gotten my husband on the wagon. He might still be trailing a little bit further behind me. But we had a lot of struggles in first getting married. I'll just be very open. My husband had a lot of debt, and I didn't learn that until just before we got married. So imagine, you know, 5 months before a wedding, you're realizing, oh, underneath the bed, there's a box full of bills that, you know, I'm struggling with and don't know how to manage and pay. So it's taken some time. I think that he understands my point of view now. He admits that he does not like the coupons and the time that it takes at checkout, but he appreciates it and he understands how it helps us to get ahead. You know, the world is going to keep changing. The world is going to keep moving forward. And if you are not there with it and you're not on that uptrend with it, then you're going to very well get pushed and left behind. So you have to understand how to manage money, how to budget, and how to keep up with how the world is changing in order to stay afloat.
You've got an MBA in household economics, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's all from my own struggles for myself, and really a lot of late night Susie Orman talk shows that really kind of changed my financial position.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You got to admire Ebony Brown there. She lives with her husband and 3 children in Elgin, Illinois, sharing all those stories with us. And it's not just Ebony Brown. Little Rock, Arkansas, my debt is mostly medical and dental bills for procedures I needed to have. I also relied on credit cards when I lost my job. From Kirkwood, Missouri, I have about $27,000 in student loan debt, about $140,000 for my mortgage for a house I bought in order to help take care of some relatives, $10,000 in credit cards, and $15,000 in car repayment. Denver, Colorado. My debt is student loans. I took on loans because I refused to be uneducated just because of money. Socioeconomic status should not keep people from knowledge. And it sounds like you're learning a bunch of knowledge about money as well there in Denver. These personal financial stories are kind of irresistible. I mean, we could read them for the rest of the hour. I mean, I could read them for another hour, for that matter. They're kind of a deep MRI-like picture of the U.S. economy. And what they show is not people trying to get rich, but just seeking something more modest. Rachel Schneider is a senior vice president at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. She undertook an in-depth study with New York University professor Jonathan Mordock, where they spoke with 235 low- and middle-income families over a year as they handled their finances. And what they found is that families are seeking modest goals and basic stability. Their findings can be seen in the book The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And I would recommend the book just for morale boosting, if nothing else. And their research shows simple stability is as elusive for many families as that jackpot at the end of the rainbow.
We tell the story of a family in the book who earns right around the median income of U.S. households. And nonetheless, when we ask them, what's your major financial goal? The wife in the family who works full-time and her husband works full-time and they both take on part-time jobs, too, to make ends meet. She still says her main financial goal is to be able to pay all her bills on time and in full, which is shocking, right? So she's describing this constant game of whack-a-mole. She's behind on something, catching up on something else, and it's not for a lack of effort. She spends a lot of time thinking about her money, too.
And as a broad question of, you know, Americans feeling like they're doing better than their parents, you know, the kinds of things that we talk about in politics a lot – is there hope? Can you get ahead? Are you on a trend line that's upward? What do you think this means for people to be in a kind of survival state pretty much their whole lives?
Well, you know, you can still get ahead, but it feels more like the unusual story. And maybe that's always been the case, right? Maybe this has just been our national myth. But I think it really feels unfair to people, and it fuels a lot of anger.
And that sense of feeling desperate all the time is just, you know, something that people resent because that's not the way it should be.
Yeah, exactly. And it feels like, you know, if you're working full time, you're paying your bills on time, your kids are going to school, you're involved in your community, then shouldn't you have some level of ease, some level of confidence and security? So Sarah is worried that eventually they'll lose their home, right? Because she is occasionally behind on her mortgage in this ongoing game of which bill to pay and which bill not to pay. And that feels wrong. It feels unfair.
Is it bipartisan? In other words, people of every political orientation are having the same kind of experience?
You know, we were doing this research prior to the election. And so we actually didn't ask questions about political orientation or who you voted for. And I have to say, this has been the major question everyone has asked us now, right, as we talk about the work. Who did the people in the Financial Diaries vote for? And I just don't know. But I will say our study was conducted in New York, Mississippi, along the border in Ohio and Kentucky, and in California. You know, and so we were capturing urban and rural families, immigrant and native-born families. And it's not that we saw something dramatically different in any of those places, which is really more a function of how our economy has changed than anything else.
There's an argument that, okay, Americans have had it so good that they're all spoiled, and of course they don't have any financial skills because they're used to racking up credit card bills, and they see all the ads on TV that entitle them to big screen TVs and new cars all the time. And of course they're in this situation. How do we get out of it?
You know, that narrative always troubles me because that's not what we saw from families, right? We didn't see dramatic overspending. What we saw was people who work full time but nonetheless have very unsteady or volatile incomes. So we have to focus not only on how much people earn but how does that money come into the household. And the increasingly, whether you work in the gig economy or not, people have lots of ups and downs in their earnings. Combine that with the fact that wages have been stagnant for decades, but the cost of living has gone up dramatically, right? The cost of education, healthcare, transportation, housing, they've all gone up. And so we're asking families to do something far more complicated than they used to have to do in terms of making a stable financial life out of what is inherently highly chaotic.
Is this sustainable? Did you get a sense of it can't go on like this?
I don't think it's sustainable. Absolutely not. Because what we're experiencing is that our social safety net hasn't caught up to the way work functions today. So the old model of you'll work for the same company for your, you know, the majority of your life, and over that time you'll get promoted and you'll earn more next year than you earned last year. And during that time, you'll pay down your mortgage. And so by the time you get to retirement, you'll have this nice nest egg. You'll be able to live in the house you've now paid off. That model doesn't exist for most workers now. Now most workers have multiple jobs over the course of their lives. Their incomes don't necessarily steadily rise as they move from job to job. And yet our expectations about how people would save for retirement really haven't caught up with that.
And so a President Obama preaching, we're going to have, you know, jobs for solar installers and the green economy is going to come in here and produce thousands and thousands of jobs, or the Trump narrative, which is I'm going to bring these corporations back. Neither of them speak to reality. They're both a kind of mythology that Americans can't actually take advantage of.
I think that's true. The issue is that we have to think about not only whether or not people are employed, but how that work is structured and what kinds of benefits that work delivers. So manufacturing jobs aren't inherently good jobs. They're good jobs because people unionized, the government supported people in unionizing, and then workers collectively negotiated for a whole set of benefits. So what we need to think about now is not only, you know, do we get solar jobs or bring manufacturing back to the U.S., but in the jobs that our economy is creating, which, you know, are predominantly service sector jobs, retail jobs, home health care jobs, are workers getting a fair deal? Are they getting benefits? Are they getting secure employment? Are they having opportunities for advancement? Do they have control over their schedule and some paid time off? You can deliver that through any kind of job in the economy. It requires making a decision as a society that we're going to value work in a deep way.
Rachel Schneider is co-author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. She's also Senior Vice President at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jess from Morristown, and I am in debt. I was a little bit careless with credit cards and then got psychologically rocked by the death of my cat. That may seem trite, but he was my baby. I sort of shut down and let everything go. That got me in some serious financial trouble, but I'm climbing out now.
Well, as long as you're climbing out, Jess. From Suttons Bay, Missouri, I was first in my low-income family to go to college without guidance. I stacked up tons of student loan debt and other debt. It's a serious debt sentence. I'm 38, rent my home, and have no children. I wish it were otherwise. Michael in Floral Park, New York. I'm not in debt because I've learned from my past mistakes and watched my budget. I do not wish to repeat the past, but learn from it. We want to hear from you. Tell us your story at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can find us on Facebook, of course. Tell us about your money situation and give advice to other listeners. We're listening. I'm on Twitter as well. You can tweet your questions or thoughts to me at Jay Hockenberry. And remember, if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. It won't add to your debt in any way. Take us with you on your commute home from work. We'll always keep you up to date on the news. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to find your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.